The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, I'm Nazi Hijabi. I'm a playful, agile coach, and you're listening to the Agile Uprising podcast.
Welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm Andy Clef, and my co-host is none other than Chris Merman. Hello, Chris.
And watching you lounge on a couch like you're sitting on a chaise.
I am almost doing that. We're joined today by guest Nazi Hijabi. Nazi, you gave a wonderful talk at Agile 2019's Women in Agile. Title was Nevertheless, She Finally Thinks She Persisted. And we'd like to dive into that, your experience leading up to the talk, what it was like to give it. It was your first time giving a speech in that kind of audience, what it was like afterwards. And then also dive into the topic itself, which was really, really powerful and inspiring. So let's start with, how did you find yourself in that arena?
Andy, maybe we should let her introduce herself. So Nazi, what do you want the audience to know about you before we get started on your topic?
I'm a playful agile coach, and I always smile until recently. I had a ski accident, and I felt like my whole world got upside down. And that's how I got introduced to trauma and all other things, and encouraged me to do the talk.
Coming out firing. Like, she's just like letting us have it like right away. All right. So you got me curious. You said it in the bumper, and now you're saying it again. What would you say is a playful agile coach? Like, how would you define playful in that scenario?
Playful, always. My first concern is always the teams or people I'm working with, that they are happy. So any excuse for team building, playing games, you know, for instance, at the end of retrospective, I take 15 minutes to play games, from space theme to mind mapping to, board games, any games that it helps us to be more collaborative. Even my mock programmings are fun, and people laugh at it.
I love Space Team. Can I put a plug in for Space Team? It's a great. I've done many a team outing or exercise where we started with Space Team. Whenever I took teams out, once upon a time when I led teams still, I would take them out for lunch, and while we're waiting for our table, we would play Space Team, and they're like, "Can we stop playing the game?" I'm like, "No." Not until our table is ready for us. And then I started getting yelled at for not getting reservations. So, you know, whatever.
Oh, it's self-limiting. You set that up. For our listeners who may not be familiar with that, who wants to give us the elevator summary of Space Team?
Oh, go for it, Nazi.
Space Team basically is a app game that you need to, and it can be seven or eight people that you all download. It's a free game, and you just download it on your iPhone or Android, and everybody joins at the same time, and instruction comes up on your phone, and on your mobile phone, and you just basically tell the instructions to each other, and you need to follow the instruction. The hard part of it is that the team need to listen to each other and also monitor their own instruction. And sometimes you see them yelling at the instruction, but they have it in their own phone and they get irritated or agitated, but it makes it fun, you know.
Irritated very quickly, I might.
Yes.
Is that one of the reasons you like to play the game so much, Merm?
No, well, I do like irritating people, but I seeing people get irritated, it brings not at me, right, but at something else, right? Yes, it's sort of, we all, you know, in this, what we do, we kind of do push people's buttons, whether we do it intentionally or not. Our job is to push people's buttons. So nobody can get mad at me for enjoying pushing people's buttons a little bit. You're all hypocrites if you do.
So, well, I have a question for you, Chris.
Yes. Yes.
When you're doing the games, when I do the games with seven people, we are just so loud that people from outside, they come in and they say, my God, what are you guys doing? And but we are in the office and in the conference room. How do you do it outside in the restaurant?
Well, see, so there's a couple of parameters, right? I always get us sat at the patio, right? So outside, you already have a little bit more license for volume. Yeah. Also, you know, kind of an understanding with other people, hey, this is what's going on. Very rarely have I had anybody even look at me sideways.
Okay.
Only one time I've had to say, sorry, this is a team building exercise, we're playing a game. And you know, if they had continued to look at me funny, I'd just be like, just go back to your frizzy salad. Just shut up. We're having fun. I'm more abrasive with my fun. I'm like, you will have fun. We're awesome. Our interactions in DC were very, very fun and light. You're more genuine and lighthearted with your fun, Nazi. So you're probably not as direct as I am.
No, I am not as direct. I don't know how direct you are, but no, I am not.
Nazi, I'm curious. So you mentioned a ski accident that created some physical trauma, and it sounds like you also process some interior trauma. Does that connect with your playfulness? Were you always playful, or were you perhaps more playful as a way of healing both yourself and helping your team process things that might be traumatic either in the workplace or in their lives?
So I have been always playful, and I always like to smile. So at work or personally, everybody calls me Smiley Nazi. So it doesn't matter what is going on in my life, but I always smile. My ski accident was kind of traumatic, and I broke my shoulder. And I have never broken anything. So this was my first time in my life. Joy was out of my life. So for the first few months, I really think I didn't even smile. Mm. So it, for me to be able to understand and feel that what I'm going through, I end up working with a therapist, and they told me that I have a PTSD. When they told me that, I'm like, no way, PTSD is for the soldiers who they go to in a war or something. But from there, I got introduced to the, you know, reading a book on a spoken voice, and I learned how to be compassionate to myself and allow myself to be vulnerable and accept myself and not have shame for my accident. And don't blame myself, basically.
So you got to a point where you recognized the interior injury through a licensed therapist. Interesting.
Can I just ask, like you mentioned at the very end, Nazi, you mentioned blaming yourself, right? Where do you, where obviously the feel like, or maybe I'm just inferring, it feels like the opportunity to blame yourself came up. Where do you think that feeling of blame came from?
So the feeling of blame came that, you know, even though the other person hit me from the back, the snowboarder, I felt like if I wasn't going fast, if I wasn't skiing late in the afternoon. So I started to question myself.
Yeah.
And I should have known better because I'm a good skier. So I never ski late. You know, I usually stop skiing at 2:33. So, and I relived that scenario in myself. So that's where the blame came, you know, and I blamed myself.
Isn't that funny that that same feeling really, whether it's you get into a skiing accident or you have an uncomfortable conversation with a partner or a coworker, or you, you know, it didn't have to be a skiing accident. It could be a car accident, or it could be, you know, something didn't go your way at work or whatever it is. Like, it seems like those situations face us every day where we say, I should have known better. I should have done first. And thank God that we're willing to look at ourselves in the mirror before just immediately blaming the other party. But it seems like there's just as much damage to be done by looking in the mirror first in a negative way, rather than just as well as it would be just to yell obscenities at that skier, that snowboarder, and, you know, blame them for everything, right?
That is true. And I think another impact of that is that you, when you blame yourself, you lose the compassion to yourself. Mm. So you don't feel like you deserve to have a compassion. And you get into a vicious cycle, basically.
And I think the reciprocal is true in some teams, where if somebody's frustrated and they blame the other, they also take away compassion from that relationship with that person. And I'm curious, so how are you bringing this into the workplace? You got to a point where you could recognize quickly the physical trauma and the PT that you have done, the emotional trauma. And then do you have a new awareness in a team space of people that have unprocessed or unrealized trauma in themselves? Do you have a new radar for that?
Yes. So
what's that like?
So I call kind of physical trauma or very big trauma a T, big T trauma, and the ones that it's like you are overwhelmed, you are anxious, or you are, you know, you are frustrated. Small trauma, which is with the small T. Just being an observant, you know, as an agile coach, when I am working with my team, for instance, you know, I worked with a brand new team. I noticed that one of the team members during daily stand-up, she just mentions, I'm working on this. And whenever we went to a team, you know, lunch or happy hour, she wouldn't participate. Or whenever she came, she was just quiet. Anybody tried to talk to her, she would not say anything and she would leave. Just observing this, you don't understand. I didn't understand immediately.
But you saw something.
But I saw something, and during our mobbing that we did for the first time, I noticed that at the end, I know she was fidgeting and she crossed her arms around her body, but I kind of ignored it. I thought she's just nervous. And at the end of the meeting, when I said, who wants to, you know, to participate, this was my first mobbing with them. I said, who wants to do this again? 17 members raised their hand and she didn't. So I made a conclusion, okay, majority rules and we're gonna do it. Just by saying that, she got irritated and she yelled at me kind of, you know, and looking at my eyes, and she's like, Nazi, you wasted 90 minutes of my time.
Ouch.
Mm. And why do you want to schedule another 90 minutes? In that moment, I didn't have an answer, and the mobbing ended. But I thought about it, and because I was going through my own ski accident and, you know, how I dealt with my own emotional feelings, I noticed that how vulnerable she is and how she feels. So that is, then I put the pieces together, and it made it easy for me to understand that she's overwhelmed, she's anxious, and she cannot cope with the basic programming that we are doing, and thought about the solution, that what can we do for, you know, what can I do to make it safe for her, that she feels safe and just participate with us.
So she was shutting down, checking out of her own fear and anxiety, and you tune into that. So what happened on the second mobbing session? What did you change? Did she participate?
So, and I want to add to the first one also, the intensity went higher, because when she was on the first mobbing, when she went behind the keyboard, she wasn't familiar with the environment, and then 3-4 people yelled at her, like, you know, control command D, and she got more nervous. That is how the intensity went higher. What I did the next time, basically it's a trial and error. You know, that doesn't mean every time you do something, it becomes successful.
Of course.
Yes.
what are your odds, Merman? Are you like 6 out of 10 fail?
Probably. Yeah, probably higher than that.
You're hitting 350 and it's good.
I lean into failure. I love it. I love it.
But I think when you have compassion to other people, or you are not judging them, it just makes it a little bit easier, you know, to understand them and also, you know, to accept your own mistakes. So I asked her, I told her in one of the daily stand-up, and I said, anybody can participate and be an observer, and you don't need to be part of the mobbing or group programming. So that encouraged her to come and just sit there and see us do programming. By doing that, to my surprise, at the end of the meeting, she, during our retrospective, she, you know, she had a, throughout the meetings, she had a big smile on her face. So I'm like, oh, she's enjoying it. So I was very happy. And at the end, she said, during retro, she said, Nazi, if you were doing it like this, I would have attended all previous mobbing calls.
Oh, which is funny, because if you really probably boil down it down to it, it was probably almost the exact same. It's just that for whatever reason, her emotional comfort, right, or you know, mental comfort with the situation, like it eased a bit, right?
Yes.
And she gave herself permission to enjoy it and have fun, which sometimes it takes a few times, and sometimes people do it the very first time, right?
And that there's another thing, Chris, because I allowed her, I told her that it's okay just to be an observer, and you don't need to sit behind the keyboard or, you know, or navigate and tell people what to type in the keyboard.
Yeah.
We were talking earlier about our desired tendency, or just flat out joy in pushing people to that edge and helping them cross and come back. And I think everybody has that edge in a different place. And it sounds like, Nazi, you found, you asked her to step further than she could comfortably the first day, but created a spot where she wasn't panicking, but she was a little uncomfortable, and then embraced that. Well done.
Thank you.
But it requires safety in that space, and the ability to be vulnerable. And for her to say, I'm not comfortable, is difficult for some people. Sometimes people just keep quiet, cross their arms, and sit in a corner.
Yeah, so, but the incentive for me and the tech lead was that we wanted her to participate, because her skill set was much less than, you know, she was not senior as the other ones. So what I did for me to make her a safe environment, I thought, okay, I'm going to try to make sure that she understands it's okay not to know the answers. So even though I'm a less technical agile coach, I told the team that I am going to participate in mobbing. So when I went behind the keyboard, I would ask people like, okay, what do I need to type? And I had to ask them to repeat. When I became a navigator, I would say some portion of it, but the other portion, I would ask them, okay, can you help me with that? Then she observed that, oh, you know, Nazi is making fool of herself. She doesn't know, and she volunteered to participate. When I did that, in the same mobbing, I asked her, would you like to join us and do this? I created a safe environment, and I was the only one within the team that didn't know the answers and was asking to the team to repeat the same thing maybe multiple times. And then that was the safe environment for her, and she joined us.
And it was true to yourself. It was playful, too. You didn't pretend. You didn't have cue cards. You made it transparent, and I'm sure you smiled the whole time.
I was smiling because I was watching her, how she's reacting, so.
Yeah.
So Nazi didn't say this with her words, so I don't want to put these in her mouth, but what I feel like, what I feel like she was doing was saying, I'm okay. I'm okay if I'm kind of chuckled at. I'm okay to be the butt of the joke. I always, I tell newer folks that, you know, if I ever get asked for thoughts or ideas on how to be successful, I always say, never be afraid to be laughed at. Never be afraid to be the butt of the joke. And never take yourself so seriously, right, that you can't enjoy what you're doing, and show them that it's okay to enjoy what you're doing. She, like, and for the record, Nazi, I want to state that you led several mob programming sessions. Don't ever say I'm not a technical coach. Just because you don't know, you may not be a Java developer, you may not know methods or whatever, but don't ever say that again, that you're not a technical coach. You led a mob programming session. You're good as far as I'm concerned. There are so many of us, so many of our listeners, never done that ever in their lives. Some of them have never even written a spike story before. So, like, you're fine.
So I'm gonna tell you something, and still I'm gonna say I'm a less technical coach. I have a computer science degree from UC Irvine, and I used to be a programmer, but long time ago. Don't ask me how long ago.
We can look it up, and our listeners, we can go check the UC Irvine records and.
I have a bachelor's of liberal arts and journalism. Right, I'm still less technical, and I am plenty technical for what needs to be to get done. Right, I'm not sitting down helping developers clean up tech debt. And I realize that you're using the microphone of someone that is probably way more technical than you, but. But I'm just trying to give you credit. Right? Give yourself more credit than you think.
Thank you. I want to say also something, Chris, that you said. It's very important. Usually the team or even the middle level management, they look up for agile coaches as a leader. So when I am able to put myself in a position, or I apologize to the team, or I say I made a mistake, I put them in ease that it is good, it's okay to make a mistake, like you were saying. Mm-hmm. So it's very important to, you know, to be able to give that, you know, safety, because they look up to us, and it helps the team a lot if we can be human and, you know, and not worried that, oh my God, my credibility is going to be ruined if I apologize or I create an environment like that.
It's making mistakes okay and making failure okay. There's a wonderful coach that Michelle and she paired up with Erica Lenz a few years back at Mile High Agile, and she was saying, we need to bring back the failure bell. And agile coaches, we need to bring back the formal failure bell that you can say publicly in the team in a big way that's true to yourself. I effed up, and here's what I've learned. And thank you for putting up with me. Even that small little trauma, right?
Yeah.
Of like, I screwed that one up. I yelled. I lost my cool. What do you think, Chris?
No, I just think that there's something incredibly, like what Nazi said about the being human piece, right? Like permission to be human. That what I think is really interesting that makes all of us in this industry different is that being human can mean different things, right? So So for example, right, like after hearing that story and how it transformed you a little bit in your approach to teams and agility, Nazi, like your humanity took on sort of a slightly different form, or maybe just had a different lens, or whatever buzzword we want to use to describe it, right? But like, there's others of us that they're able to see more strategically. There are those of us that are better, more team and ground level based. There are those of us that kind of mentor better, right? But that the human, like the way that we're human together, really, really sets us apart. And nobody can tell us how to be human, right? Like we're all human in our own weird, like this sounds like we should be singing Kumbaya around a campfire. I'm just saying, like, the human piece is what really sets us and makes us unique. It sets us apart.
I think I want to also add that being vulnerable. So I had a hard time as I was working on this talk with Women in Agile, New Voices. I had a hard time that how much do I want to share with audience and also be authentic. It took me a long time to be able to do that. And I think as an agile coach also, that vulnerability in our mind creates a weakness, but in reality it is, and this is not a quote from me, this is what I learned from Brené Brown. And I think after my accident and going through the trauma, watching Brené Brown's, you know, the TED talk or other things or any book that I read about trauma, it had a different meaning than when I watched Brené Brown for the first time. I'm like, oh, okay, vulnerability and this and that. But when you are in middle of it, it you get a different perspective.
It's helpful to have some sort of guide. And you are providing that now with your teams, with what you've learned. I want to go back to the talk a little bit. So what did you struggle with? What did you keep? What did you toss out in that talk? So, 'cause you didn't have a huge time box, so you really had to be ruthless with your editing. But what were some of the really questionable areas for you as you were developing your content?
So until the day of the Woman in Agile on Sunday, I think I wasn't authentic. So I would kind of, when I was doing my practices, I would talk about the talk, but as a third person, like I was reporting. And one thing that helped me, because I practiced a lot, I don't know what happened really during the Woman in Agile. I think I saw everybody so energetic, so supportive. I saw so much warmth, and looking at everybody, I felt like all of them, they are cheering me up and they are rooting for me. So I just went inside and allowed my emotions to come out and talk to everybody instead of reporting, like going through my presentation basically.
I love that. How did you log your emotions?
So as I was practicing, for instance, with Faye Thompson, who was my mentor, she would tell me, Nazi, be authentic. And I'm like, okay, I am authentic. I'm telling the truth. And I was telling the truth, but I wasn't letting myself feel the emotion. So I think it was everybody's energy, that there was a point in the talk when I was talking about my physical therapy and stuff, I literally was so deep within my emotion that I was barely stopped myself from crying, and I pulled away. And that was what I was, that was what Faye was asking me, to go deep when I'm talking about, my trauma or other things. And I don't know what happened, so.
We all saw it, and we'll include a link in the show notes to the presentation. So for those who were not able to attend, you can relive it to some degree. It's not the same as being in the room with Nazi when she's her smiling, authentic self deep in the performance.
I love what she was saying. It almost sounds like you kind of like got into this weird state of, maybe not weird, it wasn't weird, but in this state of like, you're not sure really where you were or what's going on. You just start talking and you get really enveloped in the moment. I feel like that's something that Andy and I know both can empathize with, because there's times where you look up and it's been, you know, 20 minutes of speaking and you're like, what? I feel like I just got started talking, or you get lost in this moment, right? Because you're so connected to yourself. Like, that's got to be an incredibly invigorating feeling, right?
Yes. And I think I want to also give the credit to everybody, including you and Andy and everybody else, that they are in Woman in Agile. It doesn't feel like you are in a conference. People there, they are really cheering up for you. They really want you to be successful. And the mood of the room is different. Yes, there is a few hundred people there, but it feels like I'm in a meetup group, or it feels like, you know, because I know some of the people, and also the whole environment is like, they just really want you to be successful. And you feel like, okay, I'm not gonna, you know, I'm not gonna fail. Even if I mess up, these people, the people that they are in this room, they're gonna forgive me. And that feeling was okay to be, made me okay to be vulnerable and go deep inside.
And to add to that, Nazi, you were authentic, right? So I heard somebody describe.
Andy, pause, Andy. Can you put a few words to what you mean by being, maybe a few people, like we've heard people, like people are hearing us say being authentic, but like, it seems pretty no duh, but for those that maybe are going, well, what does that even mean to be authentic?
I have a thought, and maybe this helps. So I have some friends who are top notch actors, improv people, performers, and keynote speakers. And they described it as stop presenting, start performing, and performing in an acting sort of way, so that you become the story authentically. You're not just presenting slides, reading your slide notes. So you rehearse, Nazi. You rehearsed and rehearsed. And during your rehearsal, it sounds like you were being coached to not present, but to actually perform and be that Nazi in that moment. And that's what I mean by authenticity.
Yeah, relive that.
You're performing it, and that's why the audience responds. If you were flat up there and just presenting your notes in the next slide, and this is when I hit the tree, it would have been a loving audience, and people would have given you the gift of, that was a good presentation. How are you going to perform it? You know, I didn't feel it. But what you got back was this give and take, this magic that happens when the audience is there and listening, and you are performing and being yourself. It's a wonderful moment.
So I had a secret. And the secret was that I went to storytelling workshop.
Tell us more about that secret, listeners. Pay attention.
Yes. So there was a two-day workshop for storytelling with Dixie. I don't remember her last name. And there are lots of other workshops for storytelling. So she taught us the template and how to talk about the emotions, how you need to go through the, you know, create a conflict, go to the arc. And also, like you said, Andy, that to make sure that to create a picture or an image that the audience can feel that they are in that room or whatever I'm describing, that they are there. And I asked that person, as I was working with Faye, I also asked this Dixie to work with me. So I was working with her also. And I also did other things. So have you guys heard of Story Moth or, you know, like the moth storytelling or the moth? They have...
I haven't.
No? Okay, please, please, you know, go to... they have it all over US.
Okay.
In big cities. So basically, it's an open mic environment. And you just put your name in a hat, and they have a theme. And then from that theme, and the theme, the one that I spoke there as a practice was, it wasn't a trauma, but something related to that. And they just pick your name. If they pick your name, you go on the mic and you talk. So I practiced in there also. And that is kind of, they teach you storytelling. So all of this also helped me.
I'm looking at it right now. It's themoth.org, Andy. This is now, yes. Now I need to like, I'm now enthralled and need to dive deeper into
I know what you're doing next week, Merm.
Yeah. I'm finding a local meetup. What I love what you said, Nazi, is that like you, it wasn't your, like Andy was stating, like your topic was great, right? It clearly came from a place of personal history, right? You're just retelling your story, but it's not just the topic. It's not just the content, right? So whether you're giving a presentation on how to do backlog refinement, or you're telling the story of how, you know, you ran into a tree skiing, right? The idea is that you, if you're going to tell that story, if it's personal to you, you'll place yourself back in that moment when you're sharing what it was like. What all Faye was doing was asking you, place yourself where you were, tell the story from your heart. Like, what did it feel like? How was, like, put yourself there in that moment. And you can do that with a less personal story. You can put yourself in a, oh, I did this before and it was really hard when I did it, but here's what I've learned and here's how we learned the mob program as a result or whatever, right? Like it doesn't matter. You just putting yourself in the story, put yourself in the story, and that makes the story more relevant. And I love that that's what you're telling us to do, because it sounds so easy to describe and so hard to do.
And remember, you're making yourself vulnerable, because I am telling you how I felt emotionally and all other things. So, you know, I think accepting that it is good, but I highly recommend everybody to go to the moth. Even if you don't want to participate, just listen in, and people have amazing stories that they tell. And there is one rule in there. You have to be truthful, so that you cannot tell about somebody else's story or make up on a story. So it has to be a real event, and then that happened to you that you can share with everybody.
There's a story called I Am Batman.
It's already been done. Oh.
Yeah. I know. Now I want to fight this guy because I'm Batman. What you just said is so really crucial, Nazi. Like it's scary to put yourself in the story that you're telling, because if the audience or whoever doesn't receive the story the way that you were hoping to, then in a way it can feel like they're rejecting you, right? Because if you're in the story and they're rejecting the story, then they could be rejecting you. But if you can get past that, if you can truly get past that discomfort of, well, they're not really rejecting me. Maybe it just doesn't resonate with them. Maybe they've not been through it. I listened to your story, Nazi, and was like, wow, that sucks. I've been skiing so many times. I've never run into a tree. That sounds awful, but I'm so glad that she came from it. That doesn't mean that I rejected you. It just means that I've never experienced that before. But I did experience the part where the trauma, because we all know trauma in different ways, kind of a thing. So we have to trust that the audience, if we put ourselves in that story, they will connect with it. They will connect with us. Even if the topic is not necessarily the one that lines up, they will connect with us. And I love that you're showing us that.
Yeah. And I think even if you've never been skiing, there's a way that you told the story that it resonates with people. And then that's part of your craft of storytelling, Nazi, where you can tell a story and someone can imagine, well, I don't know what it's like to ski, but I can certainly know what it feels like to hit a tree at 30 miles an hour, right? And feel out of control. And then what happens with that? I'm curious. So what's next? What's coming up? You've done this talk. What are your goals, aspirations for the near future?
So I want to make, so like you said, Andy, I cut this talk because this talk was, you know, like 20 minutes, 25 minutes. I could have easily make it like around 30, 40 minutes, but I cut from every aspect of it so that, you know, I can fit 7 minutes. I want to work on this to make it a little bit, you know, like 30 minute talk and, you know, do it at the meetup groups or in, you know, any small conferences. I also want to, you know, I'm looking to see like if I, you know, create a talk for mobbing as a less technical coach and, you know, do more podcasts and things like that and recover. So I am still in my recovery mode and I am spending time to, you know, watch again Brené Brown, read my trauma book. And every time I read, I get a different perspective and I get the more aha or deeper understanding, which is helping me a lot how I observe people from my teams or my friends or other people like that.
Yeah, it's you're constantly trying to see where we're always, there's like a river or a stream that we're like walking up and down in life. And if we don't take the time to see where we are, right? We don't give ourselves a chance to be okay with where we are, but also we can't really see like, wow, I've actually come like a really long way. Or maybe I took a step back, but I like look at all the road ahead of me that I can go. And that's what I feel like you're doing. After doing the talk, did the story resonate differently for you? Did the feedback help you resonate your journey differently?
So I'm going to make a confession. After my talk, you know, some people came to me and they are like, oh, you did a great job. And one of the ladies I knew, as soon as they said that, and I'm like, no, I didn't do this. I messed up. And one person said something nice. She said, Nazi, just breathe. Enjoy your talk. You did a good job. Don't analyze yourself. And that kind of put me in a place that I'm like, okay, I made a mistake, but whatever mistake I'm thinking, it's okay.
You played right through it. You played right through the mistake. Nobody noticed it but you.
Repeat after me is, thank you so much for coming. And in your head, you're saying like, I sucked. You're saying,
yes.
Thank you so, I'm so glad. So if you ever come up to me after a conference, if you see me speak and you're like, oh, like whatever, you say whatever, you make fun of me, you say thank you, whatever, I'm gonna say thank you so much for coming. I'm probably making fun of myself in my head, but I'm never gonna let you know that. You're thanking me? I sucked, and that's awful. You shouldn't be thanking me because I sucked, and that's all there is to it. Like, what? maybe just say, oh, I'm so glad you came. Thank you so much. Like, I'm tearing myself down in my head.
No, but I think also Brené Brown said, like, when you have a shame about something, when you talk with other people, that is the anecdote and you get rid of the shame.
Love that.
So that talk also over there, I mean, at Woman in Agile, helped me to kind of close that chapter of the trauma that I was, you know, dealing with. So little by little, I was getting better. But Woman in Agile, when I talked about it, I just completely closed it and I started my new chapter of my life. So that is kind of, you know, my trauma, my surgery and everything is past. And it really was helpful.
I look forward to the next chapter. I want to thank you, Nazi, for spending this time with us. Also to our listening audience, hope you enjoyed the show. Please give us a review, a rating. Leave some comments on your podcast feed of choice.
Find Nazi telling this a longer version of the story in the future, because I smell a few future podcasts coming, or some spoken word, right? Like there's clearly more to this story that we haven't been told.
Well, she cut it down to 7 minutes, and she has like 25 that was ready, and another 30.
No, there's more coming, people. So what I'm saying is, find Nazi at a conference in the near future, because this is a story that needs to be told again and again and again.
Yeah, we just saw the trailer. Join us over at thecoalition.agileuprising if you want to share your stories. Engage with Nazi. You want to talk about trauma, vulnerability, and across, of course, good craft beer, or all three at the same time. It's always great. And finally, support from listeners just like you help us cover our hosting and production costs. See the show notes how you can help us by becoming a patron on patreon.com. Until next time, this is the Agile Uprising Podcast, signing out.
Woo!
Thank you, guys.
See, it was easy.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.